Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Your Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a bit of a battlespace tour of the war for the free world. There are few people who understand the full complexion of that war better than our first guest. He is arguably the greatest writer, or certainly one of the greatest writers of his generation. He is Mark Helprin. He has an extraordinarily important piece in the Wall Street Journal today, about which we will speak momentarily. But before we get to that, Mark, as a serious historian and strategic thinker, let's talk about Benghazi Gate, a perfect storm, perhaps, for the president of the United States that may be being obscured at the moment by this other meteorological perfect storm. But I want to see what you make, most especially of the growing evidence that the president knew what was going on the ground and chose not to send rescue forces to try to save our diplomats and others who were in mortal peril.
I think that the key fact here, and I'm not sure it's a fact because there's a lot of things that are not known publicly, not documented, but you can sort of, by feeling the elephant, make a pretty good estimate of how big the elephant is. The key fact, as far as I can see, and again, it's not nailed down, is that evidently in this four-hour assault, one of our protective SEALs, ex-SEALs in the embassy compound, had a laser designator, and he was painting targets. And there was supposedly there was either an AC-130. Gunship up above, or a Predator or a Reaper, something with the capacity to drop a precision-guided munitions on the attackers, and they could not get clearance from Washington. Now, 4 hours. If anyone who has ever been in any kind of confrontation, much less under attack with RPGs and automatic fires, knows that a second can seem like an eternity. 4 hours is a very, very long time. It's enough time for the United States to have responded, and evidently we did. Evidently we had something in the air, and we could have responded with a devastating counterfire, but we didn't. Then the question arises, why didn't we? And then you have to consider that the President of the United States is always on tap. Everywhere he goes, there's someone with a football. He has communications everywhere and anywhere, and they are instant. So for 4 hours, this attack on an American embassy, sovereign territory, in a country which we knew was flying off the handle, especially the eastern part of it in Benghazi. And where was the president? Where was the Secretary of State? Where was the Secretary of Defense? It's hard to believe that they were not informed of this attack on sovereign American territory, which is also a terrorist attack to which supposedly we should be sensitive and alert, especially since September 11th. I mean, this is what the whole government has essentially modeled itself on, is how to respond to such an attack. And nothing was done.
Mark Helprin, I think actually it was 7 hours all in with the attack on the second compound. And as best we can tell, and you're right, some of the facts are not completely nailed down, but as best we can tell, there was indeed an awareness, a situational awareness, as they say, from about an hour or so into the event. And the president was meeting with at least the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and his Secretary of Defense in the White House in the midst of all of this. We're told by Leon Panetta that, you know, the axiom of sensible military command is you don't commit forces unless you understand the circumstances into which they're being thrust. again, as somebody who has both served in the Israeli armed forces and studied history of war intensively, what do you make of that? And specifically, what does it say to those who are in harm's way around the world as we speak, whether they're diplomats or whether they're uniformed service personnel, that this is perhaps the Panetta Doctrine, as it's been called?
Well, the history of war is full of instances where the proper response, proper preparation was not given and was not made. It's something for which heads roll. And in this case, I think that what we need to know, and we will not know before the election, but one should at least speculate as to the possibilities, is what the discussion was when this was brought up. And the crucial factor would be motives. What were the motives in the response? Was it because of an idea that we shouldn't irritate the Libyans while our people were being attacked and then eventually died? Was it for domestic political reasons? Was it plain incompetence? Was it somehow a failing of understanding of the basic doctrine, not even doctrine, basic responsibilities of a commander-in-chief or any of his surrogates as to what you do if you're under attack? And I think that brings up a broader question, which is, what is the attitude of not only this president, but any president of the United States and any of his surrogates in regard to the legitimate rights of self-defense in the United States? That's essentially what your program is about, Frank. It's about countering the idea that somehow we are responsible and guilty and that we don't have the clear right of self-defense that there was a consensus in the nation that we had this, and that somehow if we respond it would be provocative or it wouldn't be justified. That's the broader question that's brought up here.
Mark, we're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk to you about. Mark Halperin, again, is our guest. He is the author most recently of In Sunlight and in Shadow, a marvelous novel, and many others, both works of fiction and nonfiction that command attention. One that I'm particularly keen on, of course, is your op-ed article in today's Wall Street Journal entitled Capsizing U.S. Naval Policy. Tell us very quickly what it's about and what we should be doing to ensure our naval policy is sound.
Since we have very little time, I can just sort of parachute in and say two things. The first thing is that the ocean covers more than two-thirds of the Earth's surface. 90% of trade goes over the ocean. And if you just take a little part of that trade, not so little, but a part of that trade, which is energy trade, if that is interrupted or stopped, then everything stops and the whole world economy would collapse, or any nation's economy, if that nation can't ensure free trade routes to and from its shores. So it's exceedingly important, and unfortunately people don't really see this because they don't go on the ocean much and they don't look at the statistics and they're not aware of it. That's number one. So we as the preeminent naval power of the past century have the responsibility of keeping the oceans free for trade. The oceans also offer us tremendous opportunities for self-defense in terms of deterrence. So that's where we have our major and survivable missile capacity, ballistic missile capacity in submarines, and also in terms of missile defense now, since a lot of it is on surface ships. But we must have a strong navy. That's number one. Number two, China, which has three times as many people as we have, and they work three times as hard, and their growth rate is more than three times our growth rate. China is a factor which has to be taken into account. It is purposefully building up its navy. It will reach parity with our navy in 5 to 10 years, although we have been sitting on our laurels thinking, oh, that's impossible, but it is very possible. And here's the key factor there. I just want to get this in. That is that although it's proceeding steadily, and we are building down, as they say, steadily, as it builds up steadily, the United States has roughly 6 major shipyards. China has 100. That means that when Chinese naval weapon systems are sufficiently mature, when they're confident of them, then they can surge, if they wish, and build a navy so many times larger than our navy, just as we did in World War II. We won World War II because of our industrial capacity, which our opponents could not match. We can't even begin to match China's shipbuilding capacity. When it chooses, it can, in the present circumstances, the way things are laid out. It can so easily overwhelm us, and then its fleets would be cruising off our shores, and we would have no remedy and no option, and essentially it would control the world. And given its behavior in the South China Sea, which it has seized more or less, it's in the process of seizing the way Hitler marched into the Rhineland or took Poland. It's very aggressive, and we have no response because we simply don't have the muscle to respond that far away from home at this time.
Yeah, it's a rhetoric-only policy at the moment.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say
sweater?
That?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Bing West, a former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan Defense Department. He has been very active in the years subsequent to his service in that capacity, and prior to that, his service in the United States Marine Corps. As one of the most thoughtful and most personally engaged of the commentators and analysts of the war we're in, and Bing has just penned a very important piece that is on National Review Online today entitled Benghazi, Obama Emerges from the Fog of War. Bing West, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Tell us in what way the president has emerged and what we now know from that emergence.
Well, Frank, 6 weeks ago on 9/11, our ambassador was killed and our consulate ransacked in Libya. And subsequently, the president for 5 or 6 weeks had been saying, after the event, I ordered security at our embassies. And now, 2 days ago, he came out and said, actually, the minute I heard about this, I ordered the safeguarding of our people. Well, he heard about it 1 hour into the fight, but the fight went on for 7 hours. So it raises the whole question of how the national security system under the president actually works. And I've looked at this very carefully now for several weeks, and I've come to three overall conclusions. That first, if you watch the president, his attitude toward force is that it is an immaculate act that is based upon months of preparation for one individual action, such as killing Osama bin Laden. And that stands in marked contrast to real war. I mean, that is, nothing happened in Benghazi. Our military didn't do a thing for 7 hours. And yet our embassy, God bless them, that were 400 miles away from Benghazi, they immediately improvised and sent a plane with six Americans to help. But our military, 480 miles away, never sent a plane overhead to help and never sent any forces. They were incapable of improvising. But it appears that the notion of the president really infected everyone, and that is this concept that you really have to plan everything exactly or you do nothing. And that's the exact opposite, if you consider, of the chaos of war. And also of what, for instance, the New York City Fire Department did in the midst of 9/11. They rushed in. They didn't wait until they had orders or something. And that relates then to the second issue, which is the command style. If you have a style that paralyzes your military, what's the sense of having a military? And for the Secretary of Defense to defend this by saying, well, it's a principle of war that you don't send your forces into harm's way until you have enough information of what's going on. Holy smokes, then you never fight a war. But at the same time, we did have that information because we had people on the ground talking to the White House. So in the end, I concluded what you had here was groupthink. That is, the administration wanted to say it was a mob, stirred up by some obscure video, because that's what happened in Cairo, and that excused them from saying that terrorism was still lurking out there after they had taken all the credit for getting rid of terrorism.
Mm. Bing, you have both practiced the art of war and studied it seriously, written about it intensively, including in your book, The Wrong War, Grit, Strategy, and the Way Out of Afghanistan. You have in this piece in National Review Online a very, well, poignant expression of concern as to what do we say to those troops we're sending out on patrol in Afghanistan in what's clearly the waning days of this operation that will give them some comfort when they never know what it is they're going to get themselves into, except almost always some kind of mess under the present circumstances. How is this likely to be seen by our warfighters as a commander-in-chief operating mode and practice?
I regret having to say what I'm about to say. I wrote a book a few months ago, it's now out, called Into the Fire, with the Medal of Honor recipient, Sergeant Dakota Meyer, extraordinary brave man, in Afghanistan, thank you, where he received no fire support for 6 hours. Because at the top, the generals had this idea that we had to be very careful of civilian casualties, otherwise we'd upset people. And therefore, we couldn't use our force, even when our own people were dying. I thought that was the end of it with that book. But holy cow, Frank, that's exactly the rationale now that I have heard on television from General Keane, whom I respect very much, the former Vice Chief of Staff of the Army, and from Secretary Panetta and others, in essence saying, you wanted us to send an F-16 over there to bomb this mortar position that killed our brave Navy SEAL, Tyrone Woods. But if we had dropped any bombs on the mortar, we may have killed some civilians. And therefore, you can't expect us to do that. We have gotten to the point with our senior generals in this new, kinder, gentler way of looking at war where
casualties for civilians are off the table, and our forces have to take the risks accordingly. And the reason I don't like saying that, Frank, is that I'm just back from Afghanistan, where, again, I was out with our troops. And there is a creeping cynicism among those at the company level that are going out on these patrols that they can expect darn little help in terms of aircraft or artillery helping them in a firefight. And therefore, they become risk-averse, but they become very skeptical about their own chain of command. And I think that's deadly. That really concerns me.
It's corrosive in the extreme. And Bing, what you've sort of touched on here is the rot, I would argue, that we've now seen set in the name of this so-called counterinsurgency strategy. And it clearly is putting our guys in extremely difficult, if not the hopelessly untenable positions, lest we not simply put at risk civilians, but we upset them, we offend them, and to some extent, this really seems to me being indistinguishable from kind of the whole strategy of our Islamist enemies, namely to make us submit to them. Does that trouble you?
No. I can only, unfortunately, I think you're correct. And my only hope is, well, I have two hopes. Of course, I have concluded for many reasons that I believe President Obama should not have a second term. And I'm hoping that Governor Romney is elected. If President Obama is reelected, I certainly hope that by now he has learned a lesson that apologizing for America and believing somehow he can turn the Islamist radicals in his favor or something, or somehow defang them, just hasn't worked, and it has caused this notion in the Middle East that's the worst of all notions, that number one, we're not your friends, and number two, we think you're weak. Holy cow, that's a dangerous combination that we've gradually gotten ourselves into.
Formula for disaster. Bing, very quickly, just a minute left. What do you make of the conduct of our senior generals, specifically General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in all of this?
Frank, I am disappointed. I am very disappointed in a series of actions now by General Dempsey. He was a good division commander in Iraq. He now appears to be almost timid. He appears to be too much in awe of the politicians and the officials that I think in his heart he knows are not doing the right thing. I think everyone gives somebody advice, but I think General Dempsey would be well advised to stand back and be like General Marshall and just put up a bit of resistance toward any of the civilians and not look at himself as being part of the Obama team, but rather as the military advisor to any president, period.
Right. Got it. Bing West, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate enormously your new piece at National Review Online. Check it out, folks. It is entitled Benghazi, Obama Emerges from the Fog of War. We'll look forward to talking with you again soon, Bing. Thanks so much. Next up, we will be speaking with Noni Darwish. We'll get her take on this Sharia blasphemy business. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, parents. Finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi, son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, I'll fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you.
For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Barack Obama faces two perfect storms. He may actually be grateful for the meteorological one if it helps obscure the political one. Hurricane Sandy is, of course, a disaster no one would welcome. Untold numbers of Americans are going to have their lives endangered or at least disrupted, and the potential economic harm is unimaginable at this point. The president could, nonetheless, see a silver lining in this horrific weather event. Many voters are going to have other things on their minds besides the evidence that their commander-in-chief was seriously derelict regarding the murderous attack in Benghazi, not a decisive wartime leader. It behooves all of us, and most especially the mainstream media, to stay focused despite the hurricane-force winds, blackouts, and flooding on the insights and lessons of the still-unfolding Benghazi Gate firestorm. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at SecureFreedomRadio.com.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
I'm a champion. Realize checks mechanism.
Hi, Shaquille O'Neal for Rad. This is not your normal PSA. Don't be stupid. Don't drink and drive. If you're going to go out and have a good time, it's fine. But designate a driver to drive home. Let's stop the madness. Don't drink and drive.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We are joined by one of the people I admire most in the world. She is a woman of extraordinary courage, an articulate advocate for America, her adopted country, in the face of threats posed to it, both abroad and here, by the religion and doctrine that she extricated herself from, Islam's doctrine of Sharia specifically. And Noni, it is always a treat to have you with us, but I'm particularly glad to have you here to follow up on the conversation I just had with Bing West about the extent to which the United States, specifically, let's start with the United States military, is through its so-called counterinsurgency strategy and now its practice more generally, emanating from a sign of submissiveness, of a determination to accommodate our enemies, even at extreme peril to our own forces. Does that sound right to you, and is that a thing we should be concerned about?
Oh, we should absolutely be concerned about, especially for somebody like me, and I see the parallels now in Egypt, for instance. When I was growing up, I could see a lot of people hurt in the government for speaking their mind. So I'm seeing a trend moving here, with the Obama administration, pressuring a lot of people in our government, in our military, to be so politically correct that they will, ignore the threat of terrorism and Islam, because they are all worried about their jobs. And this is too close to home for me. It just scares the hell out of me.
Yeah, understandably. You, of course, left Egypt to come here to get away from this business. To what extent, based on your intimate knowledge of what the doctrine of Sharia requires, and by the way, you have, among other things, written beautifully about it in several of your books, including Cruel and Usual Punishment, The Terrifying Global Implications of Islamic Law. By doctrine, how are adherents to Sharia supposed to respond when they see the infidel submitting?
Oh, absolutely. What happened is, according to Sharia, it is a crime for the enemies of Islam, the non-Muslims, to defend themselves if Muslims attack in jihad. And what happened in Libya is just scares me so much, because the way we chose not to respond is the typical reaction that Islamic Sharia expects from its enemies.
And is it fair to say that the response typically then is supposed to be, under Sharia, to redouble the effort to make them feel subdued, as they say?
Exactly. In order to stop further attacks, further terror, further humiliation. So Muslims, when they see the submission, a total submission after a terror act of their enemies, this is how they judge that, okay, now we can stop. But the minute the enemy resists, or does not want to submit, that's when they start speaking ill about them, claiming that they have attacked them. They do a lot of slander and lying, which is permissible under Sharia about the enemy. And that is why I'm just so, I can't believe why President Obama chose to bring Libyan security to defend the embassy and the consulate. The reason is he should know, and our administration should know, that Muslims are not supposed to be guarding enemies of Islam against other Muslims, even if they are terrorists. According to Sharia, the Muslim guards, if they shoot at other Muslims to defend an American, they'd be violating Sharia themselves and would be killed.
And of course, these folks aren't terrorists, according to Sharia. They're the heroes.
They are the heroes.
Leaders of
according
jihad.
According to Sharia, they are doing jihad. They are doing God's work. So
now, let me just ask you, Noni, because one of the other things, and we talked again about this bit with Bing, is the role that the United States military, from the highest levels, are now playing in promoting this sort of strategy of submission. Specifically, talk, if you would, about this case of a lieutenant colonel that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has singled out for having offended Islam. I mean, we don't have to get into the particulars of his case, but what does it mean to those who are seeking to impose this Sharia on us, that when they see this kind of behavior, especially when what Lieutenant Colonel Matt Dooley was doing was teaching about the reality of this doctrine?
Well, the Obama administration has thrown our first, our constitution away completely. Our First Amendment rights under Obama are being threatened. I'm sure that everybody in the military and Homeland Security now are worried about their jobs in this. So this is tyranny from the Obama administration. Absolute tyranny. He is ruling by Sharia, in my opinion.
Yeah, Sharia blasphemy. And Noni, let's turn to that, because of course that was the refrain that the administration came up with when it started trying to, excuse, I guess, what was going on in Libya, was that these folks there and in Egypt and elsewhere, as you know so well, were offended by a video. They've arrested a fellow out in California, and now they're talking with the Islamists about finding ways to circumvent or bridge our First Amendment freedoms. Tell us what you make of this from the perspective of a former Muslim who intimately understands the threat that's posed by these guys.
Obama is in such tune. It's just I'm stunned by his. He's so much in tune with pleasing them. He understands Sharia fully and could give he couldn't give a damn about our Constitution. This is the President of the United States catering to Sharia, and this, you know, doesn't care about the Constitution of the United States. That is treason, in my opinion, at the highest level. Obama, you know, weeks after the 9/11 attack in Benghazi on our consulate, he went to the United Nations stating that the future must not belong to those who slander the Prophet of Islam. When I heard that, I could not believe it. I was trembling. I was scared that, I used to hear these things in Egypt by Islamists. And I used to be scared, and I never used to open my mouth when I lived in Egypt. And now in America, the President of the United States is telling me the same thing that the Islamic clerics used to say. You insult the Prophet and you die. Obama didn't say you die. He said the future will not belong to you, which is almost a threat in my opinion.
It certainly sounds that way to me, too. And Noni, I guess this is really the crux of the issue. We are being told that we must not slander the Prophet of Islam or any other aspect of Islam. And in the eyes of the beholders, those who are the Islamists adhering to the Sharia doctrine, as you know so well, almost everything, including this conversation or truth-telling of any
Not
kind,
only that,
can be slanderous.
If you read the Quran itself and the Hadith and Sirat Rasulullah, which is the life story of Muhammad, that's written by Muslims. These are Muslim scriptures. If you repeat the stories in an objectionable way, like, for instance, Muhammad married a girl at age 6 and consummated the marriage at age 9, if you say that story in a critical way, you're immediately told that you have committed blasphemy.
A capital offense. Noni, we have to let it go at that. Thank you for sharing your insights based on your hard experience with living under Sharia and your efforts to warn us as to what it means that people are trying to bring it here.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medication, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call, and I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi. This is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Dennis Prager thinks there should be a simple standard to textbooks.
I'll tell you how I think a textbook should be written. This is what happened. Period.
That is the role of the text.
And if nearly everybody who did something important in American history, if 78.9% of them were WASP males, then I want 78.9% of the textbook to reflect that fact.
I care about truth.
That's why I'm not on the left.
The Dennis Prager Show. Up in the morning and out to school. Weeknights at 10 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined, as we are each week, by our friend and very highly regarded colleague, Gordon Chang. He is our duty expert here at Secure Freedom Radio on matters involving China, Asia, and that part of the world. He is also the duty expert for such estimable organizations as Fox News, Forbes.com, where he has a column, World Affairs Journal, where he has a column, also the author of The Coming Collapse of China. And Gordon, one of the things that we're monitoring with respect to China and its future, of course, is the condition of its economy. You have been one of those who has rather assiduously been pointing out what is going wrong with the Chinese economy. What's the latest on that?
What's going wrong is that essentially it doesn't have the 7.4% growth that it claimed for the third quarter of this year. It probably had something much closer to zero, maybe 1% up, even maybe 1% down. This is especially true when we look at the most reliable indicator of Chinese economic activity, which is the production of electricity, which basically shows a zero growth economy. This is important for security analysts because Beijing is now very insecure because its legitimacy has been derived from the continual delivery of prosperity, and the downturn in the economy has accompanied some very aggressive and bellicose behavior on China's borders. And I don't think that's a coincidence because I think Chinese leaders are trying to distract the attention of the Chinese people away from the really serious problems at home.
And this is, of course, as we've been discussing, Gordon, taking place against the backdrop of the 18th Party Congress, the so-called once-in-a-decade leadership transition that is underway. That can only be complicated further by this sort of instability at home and increasing aggressiveness abroad. Any change in how you're anticipating that's going to shake out at the moment?
Well, it's been a very troubled transition this year. At the 18th Party Congress, which is slated to start November 8th, we are going to see, as you say, a once-in-a-decade transition from Hu Jintao, the current leader, presumably to Xi Jinping, the current vice president. The Communist Party right now has been fighting at the top, and this has been aggravated very interestingly by a New York Times expose of the wealth of the family of Wen Jiabao, who is the premier or head of government. This has roiled relations in Beijing even further. There was a similar expose of the family of Xi Jinping, the incoming leader, which was done by Bloomberg about 2 months ago. And so essentially we have Chinese leaders really being stripped bare in front of the Chinese people and people around the world as being taking advantage of China's economic prosperity. This has led to enormous corruption. And of course, this is roiling the Communist Party at the top as they face public accusations of taking advantages for their families.
Yeah, one of those who has gotten some unwanted attention in that regard is the premier of China, who has reportedly transformed himself while he's in office from a man of very modest means. I don't know if he was a peasant exactly, but certainly not wealthy, into a billionaire twice over. What's up with that, and what does that suggest for the future authority of the Chinese Communist Party, Gordon Chang?
There has been a number of accusations this year against Communist Party figures of great wealth. Bo Xilai, who until he was detained was the most openly ambitious and certainly he was the most charismatic of Chinese politicians, was accused of having about $1 billion. And that's probably on the light side. Premier Wen Jiabao's family is in the $3 billion range. And obviously it's a lot more because the New York Times was very careful. It documented only what it could see, and I'm sure there's a lot that it couldn't see. And that's also true of the accusations of the family of Xi Jinping. Clearly what we've got here is public records. But a lot of their wealth has been hidden beyond view. And so clearly the Chinese people are starting to view their leaders as being incredible thieves, perhaps the most successful thieves in history. This has got to further delegitimize the Communist Party. And this comes at a time when there have been accusations of lust, corruption, murder of Communist Party by Communist Party officials. And so really what we have is a leadership that is extremely insecure at this moment.
Gordon, you write in your Forbes.com column this week about the great Chinese stampede, hot money leaving the country. Is that, again, the Chinese Communist Party leadership and those with connections, as they call them, that are principally responsible for that outflow? Or is this being done by people all up and down the economic food chain? Give us a sense of the magnitude of it, too, Gordon, if you would. It's staggering.
It is staggering. No one really quite knows the amount of illicit capital flight from China. But some people are arguing it's like about $4 trillion over the last 11 years. It could be more, it could be less, we really don't know. But what is clear, though, is that from all elements of society, they're very concerned about the way the country is going. And so you have people at the top at the Communist Party, plus private businessmen, plus ordinary middle-class citizens are shipping money out of the country. And this shows a fundamental pessimism about the country's trajectory. And this, I think, indicates that we are going to see great troubles in China soon. So instead of a country that looks like it may take over the 21st century, we may have something approximating a failed state. And a failed state can be just as dangerous and probably even more dangerous than a strong and resurgent China. So right now, this is a country that is going to be stirring the pot. It is going to be the one that will, I think, initiate events in the events that history will remember.
I want to spend the remaining time we have with you today, Gordon Chang, talking about two facets of that, both intimately connected to this aggressiveness on the part of the Chinese Communist Party, whether under duress or for some larger strategic design, or both. One is that our colleague Bill Gertz discussed with us last Friday that the Chinese People's Liberation Army seems to have an element of its table of organizations, as they would call it. I think it's called the Third Department, that actually has embedded in it this core of hackers who are engaged in all kinds of cyber attacks against the United States. For the longest time, we've been told, no, this is a, you know, there's some plausible deniability between the connections these folks have to the military and to the government itself. Do you have any insights into that? Does that sound right to you, Gordon Chang?
It has been known for some time that the People's Liberation Army directly employs cyber hackers who are going not only after security targets around the world, but also commercial targets as well. They are working closely with groups of hackers employed by the state security forces. And, of course, there are freelance hackers in China as well. But one thing that's important is because China has the Great Firewall, it knows when people in China are hacking sites outside of China. So these attacks occur with the knowledge and consent of Beijing, and as Bill Gertz points out, many of them are directly employed by units of the Chinese military, Chinese government, Communist Party. So this is a state effort that is occurring, or I should say a party effort as well. This is something that Americans have to understand, that this is not just some sort of guys in their pajamas sitting in an apartment in Beijing. These are people who are employed by the state and the Communist Party.
Gordon, in the remaining minute we have, and it's not time to do justice to it, but Mark Helprin talked today and earlier in this program about China's buildup. One of the striking things he talked about was not only its naval forces and ability to deny access to its region, but also its industrial base. Something on the order of 100 shipyards are now cranking out vessels of one kind or another, a tremendous industrial base upon which to draw for the future. Do you worry about that as one facet of the threat we're facing?
Well, certainly that is of great concern because the Chinese are turning out ships and submarines and planes at a great rate. I don't think they'll be able to continue that for long because I don't think the underlying economy will support that. But the point here is that China has generals and admirals and senior colonels who are talking openly about using this stuff in the very near future, about waging war against the United States within a half decade's time. And so they have now the capability to cause great damage to the United States, its allies, and its friends. And we have to be concerned that at a point where the Chinese leaders see only a limited opportunity and limited window to cause to achieve objectives, that they actually will try something. This rhetoric from senior Chinese military officials has got to be one of the worst trends in the world today.